Welcome to Cooking the Books, an interview series about food and fiction. I'm your host, Alia Dibodard.
And I'm your host, Fran Wild. Welcome, Mary Robinette Kowal, to the 65th interview of Cooking the Books.
Ooh, 65.
We're really old.
Thank you. I am delighted to be here.
Now, you have several books and short stories in the works about space. You have books about magic, and you are an incredible cook, which is why we are so thrilled that you are here.
Wahaha.
You have fooled us all. Elliot and I have a number of questions, and then we have questions from our media partners, the Book Smugglers, as well.
So first question, very classic, and then, you know, we'll amp up the difficulty level. tell us about you and a bit about the Calculating Stars.
Sure. So a bit about me. I've been in the arts for most of my life. The things that are relevant to me that don't show up in the usual biographies, I mean, the fact that I'm a professional puppeteer and an audiobook narrator, those are things people know. What I talk about less often is my dad. I was born in 1969, and mom and dad actually sat me up to watch man land on the moon. And I say they sat me up. I was able to sit by myself. Granted, I was 6 months old, but my neighbor, who was a month older than me, could not sit, and they were very proud of the fact that I could. So I can say that I did watch us land on the moon for the first time. And I think that that has had an influence on me kind of with everything that I've done since then, because we learn from our parents, and the fact that my parents were fascinated by this, and then the fact that mom and dad, one of the things that we would actually do, which is kind of old school, even for the 70s and 80s, was I remember sitting around the radio and listening to radio plays. And Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was one of the ones that we listened to. And then going with my dad, he worked for IBM, and going with him to work when I'm really tiny. And he had, it was in the days when they were still using punch cards. So my early memories of computers are punch cards and ginormous mainframe machines. And like the first programming I did was a punch card. I mean, it just printed my name, but still. When I started with a Lady Astronaut universe, I kind of wanted to do something that I jokingly called punch card punk, because we sent man to the moon in an era when, you know, I mean, we basically sent them in a Jiffy Pop container, and all of the math was done by women. Most of the early math for the space program was done by hand or with mechanical calculators before we had computers, mechanical computers.
That's where the term computers comes from.
Exactly. So all of that wound up rolling together to become the Lady Astronaut of Mars, and then more specifically the Calculating Stars, where I really wanted to look at what we could have done in the Apollo era with the right impetus, which in my case is dropping an asteroid on Washington, D.C.
Speaking of, the Calculating Stars is a powerful look at a post-disaster space program where survival is absolutely part of the equation. And we've talked before about how science fiction addresses the issues of today in future fiction and fiction of the past that shows us going a different way. If, for instance, someone decides to drop an asteroid on Washington, D.C., how does that play out in the Calculating Stars? To whom are you speaking about survival?
So one of the things that I'm really kind of, I would say under the table, except that it's totally on the page. But one of the things that the Calculating Stars looks at is it's set in the civil rights era. And the thing about colonization, and I went back and forth on whether or not to use the word colony, because it's a very loaded word, you know, colonizing Mars. And I ultimately decided to do it because one of the things that happens is people raising the question of what happens when someone colonizes, which is that there are victors. And with the space program, there are limits to who you can take off the planet. There are kind of, as much as we would, until we get an actual space elevator, there are always going to be limits to who you can get off the planet because of the G-forces, which means that any colonization effort to save humanity is inadvertently going to become a eugenics program.
That's really creepy to think about, actually.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's incredibly creepy to think about. So this is a book that is set in the 1950s. My main character is Jewish and Southern. And because one of the fascinating things actually about the history of the computing programs is that JPL, Langley, was not segregated at all. The NACA, which was the NASA precursor, and Langley were. So if you wipe out the East Coast and the computing programs are based on integration, that means that you're going to have a lot of women of color because they were brilliant mathematicians, and those were the jobs that were available. And so the civil rights stuff is absolutely coming up and confronting her because she's Jewish, so she's aware, and in the 50s, and having grown up being born in the 20s, she would be very aware of prejudices directed at her. And then as a Southerner, she would also be constantly confronted with her own biases. So when we then add in the, and now we're going to try to get everybody off the planet, these are the kind of conversations that are happening. And when I'm talking about survival, it's not just survival of humanity, but also survival of culture, whose culture gets off the planet, and trying to make sure that one of the side effects of this, of impoverishing the United States, is that there's an international cooperation. So the ships that wind up going up have to be integrated because and so it's pushing that timeline ahead with all of the resistance that you would expect.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Sure. So if we pull back from all this terribly interesting stuff, but we also have a podcast about food, so I feel beholden to actually ask the food questions.
Despite your best efforts to try and shift this to a podcast about fountain pens.
Yeah! Well, I didn't get a chance this time. Damn it. Hang on.
I have a fountain pen with me right now.
So among the things that happen early in the book is Elma's experience with tin bins and the way that the salt is making the inside of her mouth pucker, and that's just an extraordinary detail. I was wondering what kind of research you did about the food that would have been available in those circumstances.
This is one of those things where there was a little bit of oral history going on. I have a lot of family members who are in the armed services. My dad was in the Navy. So one of the things that I remember him talking about well before I wrote this book was the food on the Navy ships. Right, which is all heavily preserved. Yeah. One of the things that he said that they would do, because he was often in the mess line, was they were using dehydrated eggs. They had fresh eggs, but they didn't have a lot of them. And those were mostly for the officers. So what they would do for the enlisted men is they'd use the dehydrated eggs, and then they would crush up an eggshell and mix it in. Because when you found a bit of eggshell, you would complain about the eggshell, but you would think you were eating real eggs.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
That is both genius and slightly worrisome, but...
Right?
So you didn't go back and find an old can of tinned beans and taste it?
No.
Because that would be gross.
That would be gross. And there is actually a limit to how long something will last, even in a tin.
Elma's favorite foods. What are they, and how does food affect one's memory of self?
So, Elma's favorite foods are basically my favorite foods, because the Southern aspect of Elma is heavily based on me. However, she's also Jewish, so there are foods that are traditional in Southern Jewish cooking, that are not in Southern Christian cooking, and vice versa. But with that said, she's very fond of a chocolate chess pie, which is one of my favorite pies. She does an oleo crust instead of a butter
I
crust
was going to ask because of the dairy.
because of the dairy. And what's interesting about it is actually that it gets closer to the way my grandmother actually cooked. She used butter flavored oleo, which is, for those of you who don't know the word, margarine. But that was a Depression era thing. And then at a certain point, it became a fashion thing that margarine, because it was newfangled, was you cooked with the artificial things because artificial was the newfangled and fashionable. And then we get into the whole wealth display kind of thing related to food. So anyway, chocolate chess pie. She will make biscuits at the drop of a hat. And I again learned to make biscuits from my grandma. There is no recipe. There are the way the ingredients shape in the palm of your hand when you're dumping them into the bowl and the way they look in the bowl. She also loves, and this one is loaded with dairy, a lemon sour cream pound cake, which is my mom's sour cream pound cake. There's also a tagliarini, which is not the way the word is actually supposed to be said, but that is by God the way my grandmother said it. Tagliarini, which was made with spiral pasta and hamburger and corn and tomato sauce. And it is one of those childhood memories of deliciousness that I'm absolutely certain that if I made today, I would be like, what were we all doing? And it's all dumped into a casserole and then shoved in the oven. So a lot of the food that Elma loves is food that my grandmother cooked because they are of similar ages. She's somewhere between my grandmother and my parents in age.
A follow-up question. She mentions early in the book that she has decided to stick more to a semi-kosher diet, in part to bear in mind why that is important.
Yeah, so I have a number of friends, and I spend a lot of time talking to friends about this. So Elma is coming from Charleston, but she's a military brat. So there was a lot of moving around, and Charleston is like the emotional home, even though she was kind of all over the place. And one of the things that happened to a lot of people is that for reasons of necessity, they became much more secular Jew than religious Jewish. But Elma's parents were very much on the secular end, and that's the way she was raised. She's like culturally, yes, but her dad has to blend in, so they didn't keep kosher in her home. But reading one of the things that happened to a lot of people after World War II and during World War II was the awareness that they were, the language was not necessarily that they were passing, that the people used in that era, but that's what they were doing. They were passing. And so a lot of people, there was a sort of resurgence for a number of communities of at least, if not keeping kosher, at least not eating pork and not eating shellfish, so that they would have to, is a very small reminder of who they were and why it was important. And I think that this is true for a number of people in other communities. Like I have friends who are secular Catholic, and they observe Lent, not for religious reasons, but because of the discipline of what it reminds them about history and the consciousness that it brings to eating. And I think that's a lot of it for Elma, is that it brings a level of consciousness to her food choices.
Okay.
So we are going to get into the book smuggler questions, and as promised, I reread The Lady Astronaut of Mars on the bus to work this morning in preparation for the interview and sobbed my eyes out again in very large capital letters, let me point out. So my first question is, given that the new book, The Calculating Stars, follows a younger Elma before Mars, and knowing what happens to her in the future, how many boxes of Kleenex do we need to buy?
I would conservatively say one for the first book, potentially two for the second.
This is like an algebra question.
Right.
So why do you say two for the second book? Can you tell us?
There's so many spoilers in answering that question. I'll say this. It does go a long way to answering it without spoilers. When I originally conceived of the books, I conceived of a single book and thought of it in terms of three length novellas. But when I got into actually writing it, I realized that there were aspects of going into space that I was going to have to jump in the second, quote, novella in order to have them have emotional weight in the third. Plus some other just emotional beats, and there was just a lot of stuff I was going to have to skip. So I talked to my editor, and structurally it made sense to have the first book and then a second book. But what this means is that there's a lot of emotional threads and other things that I have been laying the groundwork for all of book one and a lot of book two that then pay off in book two.
Okay, so three boxes of Kleenex is what we're really saying.
Basically, yeah. Potentially. I mean, some people don't cry. People are not weepers. Some people are going to be like, and why would anyone cry over this?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't really sound like Anna and Thea are in that category.
You know? Right.
There was a second part to the question, which was, so you are an author whose work focuses on women doing amazing things. What would you say are the differences and the similarities between the new series coming out and, for instance, the Glamorous series?
I have jokingly called this historical science fiction, to go with my historical fantasy, even though I know that alternate history is a perfectly good existing term.
I like historical science fiction. It's a good one.
I like the distinction, actually.
Yeah, because I'm like, this is a science fiction novel, and it's a historical novel, and there is an alternate history event, which is, hello, I'm going to drop an... Actually, the alternate history does technically start before I drop the asteroid, but the similarities... I actually did think about this consciously, and one of the things that people say repeatedly that they read the Glamorous histories for are the relationships, and specifically that I have a married couple with a stable, happy relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that I knew going into Calculating Stars was... and also knowing where the books wind up, is that I have a couple that has a happy, committed relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is a significant, important thing for me. It's not that a happy, committed relationship doesn't have conflict. There is conflict. They do have arguments, but...
There's also a lot of space innuendo.
There is a lot of space innuendo. yeah. I mean, you know, rockets and launches. It's just
too easy.
There was more space innuendo. My editor suggested that I tone it down, and I did. And I probably could have toned it down a little more, but I'm also like, I'm writing to make myself happy, and I like space innuendo kind of a lot. So happy committed relationships, lots of space innuendo, and then the other thing for me is that Elma approaches math like it's magic.
Right.
I still wanted that sense of wonder that comes from magic. And that's what I want in my science fiction, especially when I'm talking about rocket launches.
Mary Robinette Kowal, happy couples in extraordinary circumstances.
With rockets.
With
Yes.
rockets, yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. One of the lines that I cut was, let's just say that he was the sidereal motion to my gyrations.
I sense in your future, right around Valentine's Day of next year, some candies with words on them.
That
Just
is
saying.
brilliant,
All
and I am definitely going to do that.
right. So you visit NASA on occasion. You have been
Yes.
doing a lot of deep research at NASA, which is really, really cool, and I'm super jealous. How's the food there?
It depends on which NASA facility you're at.
This is the inside scoop now, ladies and gentlemen.
Right.
This is why you come to Cooking the Books.
Exactly.
Go.
So the facility at Kennedy is has clearly not been updated since, I'm going to say, the 70s, maybe 80s. It is depressing cafeteria with like lots of cracked linoleum and those weird hard plastic chairs, and then two chain restaurants that you can order from cafeteria style, and then one barbecue place.
This is where you take people when you say that you need funding desperately.
Yes. And the barbecue place is local and worthy of the name barbecue.
Oh, well, that is high compliment.
Yes. And I wish I could remember the name of it. But when you go to Johnson, to the big, so again, it's cafeteria style, but it's more like the, do you know what I mean if I said the nice museum cafeteria food?
Oh, yes.
Okay. So they have, you can, here's the, we will make a sandwich for you. Here are the nice sides. But then what they have, and this apparently rotates the make your own kind of bar. There's a salad bar. But when we were there, they had a macaroni and cheese bar.
Oh.
Right? So there's this woman standing back there with all of the macaroni and all of the different sauces and the different thing add-ins and the cheeses, and you look at it and she will mix you custom macaroni and cheese to your specifications. I had full intentions of eating healthy that day. I did not even remotely visit those intentions. Like we all just the writing excuses team just steered directly towards. So it varies significantly depending on which facility you go to.
That sounds amazing.
Yes, I have been. They are. I don't know if I will ever actually get to, but I have been angling for a trip to NASA kitchens to actually taste astronaut food. Ooh,
I
here's a.
really, 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 really want to do that
Yeah,
desperately.
right?
Yes.
There's a lot to there's a lot of opportunity there for science and for my craft.
Yes.
Obviously, it's research entirely, totally, 100%.
I will pay folding cash money if you walk in there chewing on astronaut ice cream. Just.
Interesting trivia fact, they don't get that in
Yep,
space.
exactly.
Yeah. Did I tell you about the time that I gave an astronaut his first taste of astronaut ice cream?
No.
So this is at the Nebulas when we managed to match the convention up with the penultimate shuttle launch, and
Yes.
we had Mike Fink as our guest. And I had, after the launch, we had all stopped at the gift shop, and I picked up some astronaut ice cream. And then we're sitting around in the nebula, in the Sifwa suite after the ceremony, and we're all chatting, and he says something about astronaut ice cream, and I'm like, wait a minute. And having never had it, and I pull it out of my bag, open the packet, and he's like, and he tries it. He's like, this is so strange. This is actually kind of good. Why don't we get this in space? I want this So it was a lot of fun. It is profoundly strange to put in your mouth because it's like, this is styrofoam. Wait, now it has melted and it is reminds me of ice cream, but it is not ice cream, but the strawberry is the strawberry flavor of my childhood. I don't understand what's happening in my mouth.
Yes. I had it
Yeah, you
described to me as if a Navy cook was dreaming of what was to go into space and had a really good freeze-drying machine.
Okay, so other astronaut space food trivia that that is actually in the second book. There's a line where Elma says, "You're lucky they didn't feed us kibble." True story. One of the things that they actually experimented with in the Mercury and Apollo era was astronaut kibble because they had a military nutritionist who was
Oh
a
no.
nutritionist. And he was, and it turned out that he was a veterinarian.
Okay, that sounds like the worst combination possible to be devised to prove.
Right? Yeah. Needless to say, the kibble never flew.
Thank goodness, because the morale would have sunk.
Right.
That would have,
Yeah.
it, the whole thing would have gone to the dogs. I'm so not sorry.
No, you're not.
All right, so we have about 10 minutes and we've
Oh,
got
sorry.
two more questions left. No, this has been fascinating, and I think we could probably make an entire season out of cooking the books with you. And one of them would have to be de dedicated to my least favorite vegetable, but that is for another time. So
Someday.
someday we will meet again.
When planning food for a space journey, I mean, we've touched a bit on ice cream, obviously, but what is the most important thing to remember aside from that?
Wait.
Weight, as in Weight.
Correct.
Yeah.
The weight of getting things off the planet, which is why so much is freeze-dried in plastic. After that, the things that you're looking at are nutrition and morale. Because and this is actually a really the morale aspect of it is really hugely important because food does more than just sustain us. Like if that was all we were worried about, then we really would be sending kibble up with them, because it is very light and nutritionally very sound. But the morale aspect of it is huge. So in real life, the astronauts get to pick which menu items they are taking up with them. So they get to pre-select the meals that they want for themselves. Once they get up there, they will usually swap them around.
Okay.
And there's often a lot of trading between the American astronauts and the Russian astronauts, the cosmonauts, because the food is very different.
Yes, we
In
get
my,
different things.
yeah. And then the other thing that you're looking at depends on what type of space travel you're doing, because if you're in a microgravity environment, you have to have food that does not have particulate matter, because that stuff will. So that's why they don't have bread because of the crumbs. So they do tortillas. Their salt is a saline solution, and their pepper is suspended in oil,
Oh.
which so these are all things that you have to do if you have gravity. Like if you have a spinning ring on your space station, which I do in my universe, so you have centrifugal gravity. At that point, you can have particulate matter. But the question still becomes efficiency and plotting. So one of the things that I posit, and I don't, and there's reasons that this is inefficient, but I posit that on a long duration mission, that you would have rations so that you know exactly how much food you have, but that you would also have the ability for the astronauts to cook. Because one of the things that the people on the ISS talk about is that they have, quote, recipes on the space station for what happens if you combine the food from one packet with the food from another.
They hack their food.
They hack their food, and they have condiments. And so they'll hack their food in order to have a new sensory experience and to adjust it for their mood that day. Mm. And also, you know, and for comfort. Food is, you know, we talk about comfort food. Mm-hmm. That's something that people will need, I think, on long duration missions. And also it's a way of exerting a measure of control over your environment, over, you know, when every other part of your day is pretty regimented. You've still got downtime, but there, if you are a foodie and you are in space, being able to have some control there. So one of the things that I have on the long duration mission that happens in the second book is that that there's a kitchen duty, that people actually do cook from scratch, that there are rations and they're prepackaged stuff, but there's also the opportunity and ability to just, you know, make biscuits in space.
This
which you do have to have gravity for, by the way, to do anything that's rising.
This is fascinating.
I could talk about space food for days.
Drop biscuits cannot exist in space, is what you're saying.
Not in zero G.
No. Spun biscuits, though. Ooh.
Well, see, the thing, it's actually not just that. It's the rising action.
Yeah.
Because in order for some, if you don't.
That's such a bad pun.
You know, it's just everywhere.
Welcome to Cooking the Books, the family show about space.
Oh, you meant rising action as in plot.
Whoa. Yes, absolutely. Yes, I did. Oh, God. Yeah. Hi, iTunes.
So anyway.
Anyway.
Space is amazing, and food in space is even more amazing.
Yes. Mary, thank you so much for joining us today. We have one more question, and then I'm going to say thank you again because I do that. Where can we find you and the Calculating Stars this summer?
That is an excellent question. So the easiest thing to do to figure out where I'm going to be is actually to sign up for my newsletter on my website, because we send out event lists. And that's my entire name, MaryRobinetteCowell.com. But I will be at Worldcon. I'll be at Bubonicon as guest of honor. And then for those of you who can get to Chicago, we're doing a launch party. So that is on July 7th at 7 p.m. 7 at 7. There's a costume contest if you want to do 1950s or space costumes. There are cocktails because they drink martinis constantly in these books because it is the 1950s. And hopefully there will be my mom's sour cream pound cake.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Thank you so much. I hope that you're going to drop us a recipe too.
I'm going to send you my mom's sour cream, lemon sour cream pound cake, and also the chocolate chess pie recipes.
Fantastic. Mary, thank you so much for visiting Cooking the Books with the Calculating Stars.
Thank you both, Fran and Aliette. I had a delightful time. And thanks to Book Smugglers, too.
This has been Cooking the Books, an interview series about food and fiction. Tune in next time for another interview.